on 2021, was it? Did we? I don't know if I rushed or did 20 well. 20 is a real interesting area if you weren't doing U.S. history. That's a real fascinating, I think, situation. Did we talk about Animal Farm last time?
No.
I didn't bring that up?
No.
The George Orwell book, I didn't bring that up?
No.
I read it in 1967 or something like that, so it's been some time since I've read it, but I just remember when I took a Soviet history course in the early 80s that it made the book all make a little more sense to me at that point in time. If you're not familiar with what it is, it's an Orwell book, kind of like 1984, a dystopia situation, in which a bunch of animals have a Marxist revolution and overtake the farm and start running things on the basis that all animals are equal. And, of course, what eventually happens is that the pigs elevate themselves to be above all the other animals and subjugate them, and then the life for the animals is worse under their own rule than it was under the farmer's rule, implying that Soviet Russia turned out to be worse than capitalist czarist Russia in history. But there's a scene in the book, or an event in the book that I think is really telling, and that is Farmer Jones, who's been ousted by his animals, is off in the bar sulking and drinking, telling the other farmers in the bar what's happened to his farm. And the impression we get is that the farmers don't respect him, that they kind of figure what happened to him is his own fault because he did such a sloppy job of running the farm. But nonetheless, they feel sympathy for what's happened, and they all combine together to try to help him gain back his farm from the animals. And it fails, and the revolution holds. What's the historic purpose of that part of the book? If Orwell is intending to follow real history. Yep, that's what it is. It's that last thing we talked about, the Allied intervention from 1918 to 1921. That just like, the farmers didn't respect Farmer Jones, but they sure didn't want their own animals to rise up from the role model of a successful animal revolution. So the point was to restore human control of the farm so they don't have the same dominoes falling upon them, to use a wrong expression. And that's to allude to this, that we invaded Russia in 1918 ostensibly, we and the other Allied powers invaded Russia in 1918 ostensibly for what purpose? Did I mention that? To get there eventually, but what was the most immediate reason for doing it? Restore the Tsar and or the Duma, somebody, preferably the Tsar because they had more control, to get them back into the war. And if they could get back into the war, that would keep the Germans tied up on the Eastern Front so they could win on the West. Well, we know the war ends in 1918, so why are they still hanging around until 1921? Because it's more than just getting them back into the war. It's to stop the first Soviet or Marxist revolution from ever succeeding so that working class people in other countries don't see it and try it also. So there's the parallel to the farm connection. And as we said before, when the Russians talked about who's the big threat during the Cold War, they said, we never invaded you, you invaded us, which is true, but I don't know if a 1918 to 1921 invasion constitutes the reason for all the Cold War after World War II in the 1940s, but that's where the linkage is there. But back to Wilson's reasons here in item 21. Making the world safe for democracy, fighting the war to end all wars, these were the quotes given to Congress when he went and asked for a war declaration. That may have been Wilson's parade mantra, but how many people actually shared that feeling? I see your answer is probably the one I was looking for. How many prominent, influential Americans joined into the cause because of that? Well, I guess if we all knew more about World War I, we could judge that better. But I think, there you go. It's the economic reason. People who got involved and promoted this were already involved because they had lent money to the Allies and wanted that side to win to pay back the loan. Or they were selling munitions, they wanted that trade to continue. Or people now who own businesses making consumer goods could get into the business of making war materials, not so much for the Allies, but for our own cause. Those people got involved. As is most wars, Americans, once they're persuaded and convinced that war is necessary, join in for patriotic reasons, which they did in World War One, but there was also a lot of people who did not. That's one of the significant features about World War One, which I'll say a little bit more down at the bottom of the sheet, but there are elements, geographic elements, working class elements that have great they're just not comfortable with the rationale behind the war, and as time goes on, they begin to lose support, and they have to even come up with an agency to drum up support for the war, which we'll talk some about. First, the immediate things, though, to deal with in 21 here is, after this first phrase, is how to get the logistics going and get war materials produced. If it was like Nazi Germany or Communist Russia, you would just tell the manufacturers, you'll now make tanks, you won't be making kitchen sinks for a while. But in the United States, where property was privately owned and choices were made by individual liberty, how does the government do this? They have to put together contracts and make bids and convince businesses that they need to stop making farm tools and start making machine guns. And that involves taking a risk on the part of the business. Because one of the worst things that could, I don't mean to be sarcastic, but one of the worst things that could happen to a business if they're 6 months into production is peace breaking out. Then they're in real financial hard shape. So that was the responsibility of the National War Labor Board, the War Industries Board, that was headed up by Bernard Baruch. So what Baruch did was kind of what Hoover would do later with food, and that is try to find a way to convince businesses and government to produce the amount of materials necessary by choice, by bid, rather than by force. And Bernard Baruch, by the way, here's a piece of trivia that may not be of any real great importance, is the person who in 1946 coined the phrase Cold War for the friction between the Soviets and ourselves. The second agency, the National War Labor Board, headed by Frank Walsh and former President William Howard Taft, its purpose was to convince labor unions to do the same, to stay at the jobs, be productive, guarantee that they won't go on strike, guarantee they won't go and move to other areas. In fact, when people who were in defense-sensitive industries even threatened to go on strike, they were often jailed for violating the Espionage Act at the bottom of the page. Businesses, right, the industrialists. Bernard Baruch headed up the War Industries Board. Walsh and Taft are involved in leading the National War Labor Board. The AFL supported heartily war production and the war itself. And it's probably not surprising because the AFL represents upper-class workers, skilled workers. And so they're in better working conditions to begin with, and they're probably more conservative in politics to start with.
What was the AFL?
American Federation of Labor, the one started by Gompers. And in order to sweeten the deal, the government, through the National War Labor Board, guaranteed a certain minimum wage, which was higher than market prices, also guaranteed them over hours. If they worked over 8 hours, they got time and a half, guaranteed safety standards in the factories. These are all things that the AFL had tried to fight for in the past and had trouble achieving. So from that perspective, at the start of the war, by cooperating with the government, they're getting better working conditions than they ever did prior to the war. The problem goes like this, though. The other side of what labor agreed to was a no-strike policy, which really doesn't matter. If you're getting what you need, you don't need to strike. But within the year 1917 turning into 1918, with the influx of government spending competing with private spending, what does that usually cause? If you have double the demand chasing after industrial production. Well, if you were an industry, if you're a factory owner and you're being asked to make Ouija boards and Zeppelins at the same time, doesn't take long to figure this one out. I'm going to raise the price on everything and they're going to pay it. And so when the prices go up through inflation, it's correspondingly generally wages go up too. And if employers are not willing to give the higher wages, then you go on strike to get them. But if you're in a no-strike pledge, so there was the problem, is that workers found their real wages slipping by 1918, and the traditional method of strike was not available to them. This was part of the war policy, which the AFL went along with. They said, this is our contribution. Everybody's got to make a sacrifice. This is our contribution to the war effort. We'll wait till after the war for better wage conditions. But the more radical unions, the IWW, the socialist parties, etc., they felt this to be a financial ripoff, and they also opposed the war, just opposed the war. So socialists, anarchists, generally are anti-war. for ideological reasons, personal ethics reasons. But in this particular case, the IWW and Socialist Party took the attitude that all World War I was a capitalist on one side of the ocean making profits, sending working class people to die, fighting the working class people sent by capitalists on the other side of the ocean, that there wasn't a real great threat to the United States involved. Imagine that. That's just hard to picture all that. So that's why there was not a unified labor support for the war. Herbert Hoover, have we spoken about him at all? I think I've already mentioned this, so this probably will be all repeat. We talked about Hoover in China with the Boxer Rebellion. Did I talk about the Belgian food activity? I have this memory that I did.
Yeah, he organized some kind of Belgian food relief.
Yeah, and it was successful, and later hired by Hoover to be the food administrator for the United States so that farmers, businesses, governments, military, overseas countries, all were well taken care of, not through force, not by compulsion, but by cooperative efforts. And if I think I remember this, go through this again, he was so successful at it that in the 1920s he was appointed Secretary of Commerce and continued that same policy as a Commerce Secretary. Regulatory laws, antitrust laws were kind of ignored under his Secretary leadership of the Commerce Department because he felt it's better to get businesses to work cooperatively rather than scare them with lawsuits. And the 20s are looked at as economic good times. And a lot of that is not... credit's not given to Harding and Coolidge. The credit's given to Hoover himself as the Commerce Secretary. But that's, as we said before, not the way Hoover is remembered at the end of things, because why? Yeah, the Depression hits after he's elected president in 28 primarily because of this reputation. The man who can make economic growth go through cooperative free choice rather than government force. And then when the Depression hits in 29, and his policies fail to get businesses to cooperatively cope with the Depression, then at that point he gets blamed for being the one that cared about the rich, not the poor, and he loses re-election in 32. So there's an irony there in Hoover's history. The war was, both World War I and World War II for that matter, was financed by increased income taxes and the sale of war bonds or liberty bonds by film stars, silent film stars in World War I and ones you're more familiar with in World War II, like Clark Gable and Carol Lombard and such. Item 23. Go back and talk a little bit about immigration. Do you remember from 1890 to about 1920 where most of the immigrants had started to come from? Yeah, Eastern and Southern Europe. Now, although not culturally welcome, business owners sure welcomed the lower wages that were paid. So there was a good steady surplus of labor in those years, really, but I lied in that. It wasn't to 1920. It was up to about 1915. By 1915, the ships bringing people over aren't anymore because of German submarines. So there is a cutoff of this European immigration and surplus labor in the middle of the war in 1915. At same time that war production is actually growing in the U.S., and by 1917 there's just no immigration, but here is this need for all this productivity. So with a shortage of labor at a time for a greater call for labor, where's it going to come from? It does come from the South. Some women go into the industry, not nearly as much as the Rosie the Riveter image of World War II. There are some women working in factories in World War I, but it's quite small because culturally most women themselves didn't think it was appropriate to do so. But there is a call for Southern labor, and the great majority of the Southern labor is African-American more than Anglo-Saxon. So this is the beginning of what's called the Great Migration of black people from the South to North, which continues to this day. By 1970, the census report showed that more African-Americans lived in northern cities than in southern states. So that's a steady stream from 1970. Census reports showed more African-American population in northern cities than in southern states. The census report of 1970 showed that. So that from 1915 to 1970, that's quite a growth. And in many ways, even though it's within the country, it mirrors foreign immigration. That is, people moving to northern areas, getting property, bringing family members later, bringing village members, helping sponsoring people, finding jobs for people. Northern cities like Philadelphia and Detroit and Boston and New York, large blocks become completely dominated by people who migrated from the South, who first rent, then own property, then own storefronts, then eventually go on to becoming city aldermen and police. So how does this, by the 1920s, life differ than what they'd known in the South? Yeah, much more opportunity, much more identity, much more empowerment. In fact, not just much more, for the first time maybe ever, having a sense of security and identity that is not based upon some white property owner. That is manifested also in the arts and culture in the 1920s through what's called what? What's the poetry and the dance? And Harlem Renaissance. Yeah, the Harlem Renaissance of the 20s is not just artwork or culture of the African American community, it is an expression of this nationalism, this empowerment, this identity that occurs. Well, as I said before, World War I does not have the unity of other wars, or at least of World War II. There's next to no protest in World War II. It's overnight, isolationism disappears and a unified effort following Pearl Harbor occurs. There is no decisive Pearl Harbor moment in World War I. And so there are lots of elements that are just not supportive. Midwesterners, by and large, were very lackluster about the war. The farther west of the Mississippi you got, except for California, but in the plains areas, the far less support and enthusiasm there was. Again, the thinking is, why should farm boys from Idaho risk their lives for munitions makers from Detroit or from New Jersey or something like that? So there was a lot of lack of enthusiasm to support the war because of the thinking that this, almost in a class way, is poor farmers, why should they be fighting for rich industrialists? In addition to that, there's also a large, a disproportionate amount of German-American voters in these areas. That's where a lot of the immigrants moved west of the Mississippi. And so even if a politician was anti-German or pro-World War I, they have to look and see who their voters are. And now maybe only about 25% or 30% of their people are German-Americans, but if that 30% turns out in full force and votes, then that might constitute half the vote of that election. So regardless of their own leanings, they had to be mindful of what their constituents out west voted, and usually that was not support for World War I. Jeanette Rankin's an interesting figure who is an example of this. Jeanette Rankin was the first woman elected to Congress, elected from Montana, and she did reflect the isolationist mood of the Midwest. Like other Midwestern senators, congresspersons, I should say, she voted against entry into World War I. But then her story gets a little more unique. She didn't win re-election in 1918, but she does run for re-election in 1940 and wins that race, and is therefore in Congress at the time of the Pearl Harbor attack. And when they vote to go to war there, everybody but her votes for that. She's the one person that voted against going to war in World War II. And lost re-election. Then voted against World War II, and in 1942 lost re-election again. And while liberals like myself like to celebrate her for being just a pacifist anti-war altogether, even if it's a Pearl Harbor thing, it's not as clean a story as that. She was one of those people who felt very firmly that Roosevelt had tricked us into the war and connived to let the Japanese attack, and that therefore there was not a real threat there, which historically is all screwed up and wrong. Two reasons. One is because it's wrong. Second, it's against FDR, and you just don't say things against FDR. In my camp. Well, you do, but you got to make them true. So. But she is famous for that. And then in 1968, in her last of her years, she led protests against Vietnam in Washington, D.C. So. In her the end of her life, she led a protest against the Vietnam conflict in front of the White House in 1968. Interesting character. I jumped right past 24. Because of this lack of unity for the war, the government puts together a committee, the Committee on Public Information. Well, that's if you had no further exposure to anything other than the name of the committee in wartime, a committee on public information. It does sound like propaganda. Or it could be just informing people of the news they don't get, I think, but it's informing them more of the news they're supposed to be getting. And in the high school class, we took out a dictionary and looked up the difference between education and propaganda. What do you think was the difference? Propaganda. I mean, is all education propaganda or vice versa? Doesn't sound very nice.
Well, in education, you see both sides of the story, propaganda.
That was pretty much what we were looking at. A pure definition of education was just the exposure to knowledge and facts, not the manipulation of what to do with it. For propaganda, the definition argued that it was to either hinder or to promote a cause, a person, or a policy. That could still be education, but that's what the Committee on Public Information was about. Its purpose was to get people to be pro-war. So yes, it was a propaganda agency, which is not necessarily a bad thing if the war is a good thing. Right? If you need people to get on board for a good crusade, then nothing wrong with propagandizing. Most political campaigns are propaganda. One thing about the Nazis, there's few things to praise them for, but at least you can say they were honest during World War II. They didn't call their agencies public information. They called them the propaganda ministry. At least they came right out and called it what it was. Here was the approach this committee took. First, they sent out what were called four-minute men, people who gave up in 4 minutes' time could give a rapid-fire speech explaining exactly why this war was necessary and why it was so good to be patriotic and supportive. So the first approach they took was, it's patriotic to be pro-war. It's good for the country. It makes you a good American. When that didn't work so well, then they went the low-road technique, and that was, we're fighting the damn Germans, the barbarians, the Huns, the people that looted and pillaged Belgium, the people that have never known democracy, have no respect for human rights. And when that eventually didn't work well enough, then they made it illegal to criticize the government and put people in jail for even criticizing. But in the effort to attack Germans, they made it illegal, this was state by state, but most states made it illegal in those years to teach the German language in public schools, illegal to speak German in public, or sing songs in German. We find a lot of German-American immigrants starting to anglicize their name and the spelling and quickly convert accents into American pronunciation. Certain things got renamed. Frankfurters became hot dogs. Hamburgers became Salisbury steak. Sauerkraut became Liberty cabbage.
Dachshunds became Badger dogs.
Did they really? I didn't know.
Yes. I'm serious.
So that gives some clue to the recent Freedom Fries. Remember that little occurrence that took place? Why were French fries renamed Freedom Fries?
Yeah,
that's right. So they're not going to be good lackeys. I mean allies. Then, but you know, I'll tell you who never called them Freedom Fries, stayed with French fries, was IHOP. Marola's kids piled in the car, pulled over by the cop where they were going. They were going down to get French toast. They weren't getting Freedom Toast. Russia did the same. They renamed their capital. St. Petersburg became Petrograd during World War I. And in 1924, it was renamed Leningrad, or Leningrad. And then in 1989, it was renamed, back to the original, where it was. The British royal family, which had a German name, Hanover, Saxe, Coburg, Gotha, in 1916 renamed its family name what it is today, which is what? Windsor, yeah. So that was the anglicizing of the name. So all of that was done as a cultural de-Germanification during the war, different areas. Well, as I said before, when both of those first two tactics did not bring enough people on board, then the threat of government suppression comes in item 25 through the passage of the Espionage Act, which defined a number of actions as spying or giving aid and comfort to the enemy, or the Sedition Act of 1918. I went checking, and you don't see this in many textbooks, but there was an Alien Act passed too. making it legal for the government to kick out immigrants from countries that we're at war with. That wasn't exercised very much. But when you think of an Alien Act and a Sedition Act going on at the same time in wartime, this is 1917, 1918, but does this harken back to any previous time in American history? Well, that's a little forward in history. That's World War II. So backward in Chinese were excluded, but not necessarily because of the fear of war or patriotism. This is not a major conflict. 1798, there was an undeclared naval war with the French that occurred, and there was the first Alien and Sedition Acts were passed then. It was the first challenge to the First Amendment. And Jefferson and the other party criticized anyway and tried to fight the legality of it. So there is this pattern that occurs that when a war breaks out, if the government can't get enough people on board or if the government wants to shame the opponents into looking unpatriotic, they move for these kind of laws. The Sedition Act especially is of interest. What's a definition of sedition in the traditional sense? Anybody familiar with the term? Well, it means inciting the overthrow of the government, engaging in overthrowing a government. If I was to say, hey, let's right now go overthrow the legislature in Little Rock, who's with me, let's walk, that'd be seditious. What if I wrote an article in the Portsmouth paper saying somebody ought to go overthrow the government, and somebody does and claims it was my letter to the editor that inspired them? In peacetime, you're not held responsible. That's considered free speech. In wartime, they've often narrowed that definition to mean that if you directly caused the overthrow or the attempt of the overthrow to happen, you are as guilty of sedition as is the person who participates. It's what I was hoping someone else would say rather than me. But she put it in the form of a question. Is it similar to the Patriot Act? Patriot Act is not that harsh. It doesn't say that if you verbally or in writing encourage anti-government attitudes that you're going to get canned. But it sure does allow the government to go searching into what you may have said or written because you may be suspect. It creates the atmosphere of coercion enough to make some people not speak up. Now, is that a good thing? I mean, are Alien Sedition Acts and Patriot Acts really a good thing to protect our country from treason? Definitely can be misused. Yeah. Is this knife misusable? For sure, that's a possibility.
Turn things into witch hunts.
Yeah, and it has in the past. But is there ever a reason for it? Yeah, that's its purpose, to avoid fifth column infiltration, to make sure that spies that are actually going to blow up your plants or conspire can be found. So, I mean, that's the rationale behind it. But as you pointed out, we are very uncomfortable and nervous with those kind of things. But why did the Patriot Act get passed, and why is it still on the books? And Republicans put that Patriot Act together in 2001, right? And they won the midterm elections in 2002. They won more seats. In 2004, they held the Congress, and they won the presidency. So if people were that bothered by the Patriot Act, why did the architects keep getting reelected? That's it. So what I'm getting at is during wartime, there is a certain degree of public opinion that supports tighter security and supports more government action, but mixed with the same misgivings that you're talking about. So I think before 9/11, it was very difficult to try to get across to people how this climate could resurface, but there's no explanation needed now. You can see it in what's happened. And it's not always, all on one side of an argument. There's two sides to this thing to see it from. Next page, number 26, Charles Schenck. Socialist Party member. Wrote out and ran off a large number of pamphlets that he distributed to people who were reporting for the draft. Went down to the draft station and hand out these leaflets to these people saying that the draft violated the 13th Amendment. How could that be? What does the 13th Amendment say? Well, let me read it to you here. This was ratified in 1865. Neither slavery nor involuntary servitude, except as a punishment for a crime whereof the party shall have been duly convicted, shall exist within the United States or any place subject to their jurisdiction. Now, what's that got to do with the draft? Don't have a choice. It's service that you have no choice over, even if you have not committed a crime. So do you think he has a strong argument? That's the response I wanted right there. Yeah, they had to register, and then not only do they have to register all the time and did them, but in this case, these people were being called up for service. They were being, against their will, compelled to serve. So did that violate the 13th Amendment? Yeah. Well, again, this is what I'm trying to get across is how the climate and the mood and the needs differ in wartime than to peacetime. Because what happened was Schenck was arrested for violating a ban on distributing seditious materials. He fought it in court. He lost in court, in the Supreme Court. And what the Supreme Court said, in fact, the author of the majority opinion was liberal dissenter Oliver Wendell Holmes, Jr., who usually stuck up for free speech cases. But in this case, Holmes, writing for the majority, said that if this type of speech was heeded and nobody went to serve their country, we had no military, and we lost the war, we would lose not only the war, but our Constitution, our freedoms, and our property and everything. Therefore, that type of speech represents a clear and present danger, and that's where that phrase comes from, is this court case. A clear and present danger, and would be akin to or likened to falsely shouting fire in a crowded theater. Thus, his speech is not permissible protest speech. So, what's your reaction to that? Well, then we're kind of if we accept that, then we have to go further and say, is the draft in any time, any war, a violation of our rights?
Well, I think
yeah, see, yeah, it's a hard one because if you can refuse the draft, then what do you do when the country truly is under attack? Mark Twain always put it this way: you don't need a draft because if it's a war that people really realize is necessary, they will join by the groves. And if it's a war that doesn't make sense, that's when you have to dragoon people through the draft.
Yeah,
I mean, that all.
We're supposed to,
yeah.
We're
supposed to want.
That
even as I got my summons for jury duty today, I thought about this issue. They always want me to do jury duty right at the end of the spring semester when AP exams and everything else are coming up, and there's just no time to lose. And, you know, I'm thinking, you know, well, if everybody did what I'm thinking of doing, and that's calling getting out, there'd be no juries, and then we wouldn't have justice. But then if they force people to go, then we have justice. So I'm thinking about that decision. Right. Well, it wasn't a difficult decision in World War I. Schenck stayed convicted, and so did other protesters. Including Debs himself, Eugene Victor Debs, founder of the Socialist Party, was the most outspoken and publicized opponent to the war. And he was arrested for violating the Espionage Act, given a 10-year sentence in the federal pen. It's in number 27.
And he was arrested for violation of
the Espionage Act. As we know, he ran for president a number of times. His fifth time to run for president was in 1920, after the war was over, running from jail. as a convicted felon, and receiving more votes on that occasion than any other election, 987,000 votes, nearly a million votes, which is a lot of votes for now. Think about it in the smaller population of 1920. 1921, he was pardoned by Harding and let out. But why would people in 1920 be voting for, in larger numbers than ever, a Socialist Party member in prison? Well, that's what I'm getting at, is that by 1920, a great disillusionment about the war had started to set in after the failed treaty and attitudes in the 20s. Number 28. This relates back to Wilson's reasons for going to war. I think Wilson is not naive. I think he realizes that the majority of the people who have pushed the war are not in it for idealistic democracy reasons. And he surely knows his allies aren't either, that England, France, and Italy did not engage in this war to end all wars. Oh, Victor Berger, he was a socialist mayor of Milwaukee, and I just stuck that in there because I wanted to talk about socialists a lot, and I felt the mood of the group that I'd kind of pushed the envelope enough to... I was going to add Morton Hillquist also, but I didn't mention him. A socialist mayor of Milwaukee, and did serve as a congressman from Milwaukee for a while.
Yeah, who was George Creel?
George Creel, I never mentioned him. He was the one who ran the Committee on Public Information. He was our propaganda minister. So, sorry for skipping those things, but back to 28. I can see where I'm going with this. Trying to find a parallel, it would work a lot better if we'd been in part one together. Are you familiar with the 1688 Glorious Revolution? Well, let me tell a quick little story about that so this will make some sense. Maybe it won't help, but... 1680, this issue you just don't have to write down at all. 1685, James II became King of England. And within the... Yeah, right, this is it. Within 3 years' time, James II had married a Catholic, sired a Catholic, and then jumped out of the closet and claimed he himself is a Catholic. Now, this is not going to go well in Anglican England. I mean, they've overthrown the Catholics and set up the Anglican Church, and here now one of the royal family members is... of the enemy religion of the Spanish and the French, and so this is not good. And also, the liberties that had been obtained prior to this time and the power that the Parliament had exercised, he starts to scale back. So he acts very dictatorial and tyrannical. So here's this increased executive authority in the monarch. Here is this being a Catholic. They just had enough of him, and they were out to kill him. Reading the handwriting on the wall, he ran off. And after he runs off, they quickly go over to Holland and bring family members over, William and Mary, to take his place. And William and Mary agree that they'll forever surrender monarchical authority to the check and balance of the Parliament. So they call this the Glorious Revolution. And it's called the Glorious Revolution because it was bloodless, but also because forever it put the monarchy under the control of the check and balance of Parliament. And then philosophers and everybody starts praising the Glorious Revolution as this major turn in English history towards democracy. Well, that's not why it was launched. It was launched because they were sick of a Catholic running the show. But they don't admit that. So I think, in a sense, Woodrow Wilson was facing the same opportunity. If there is a parallel there. I don't know. World War I is not started for democracy or for human rights, not by the people that started. But once the U.S. gets involved and cleans up the war and puts a twist on the end, it can become such. That's what these 14 points in number 28 are supposed to be all about. And there's obviously not 14 there, but those are the major categories of the 14 points. So what Wilson's thinking is, when the U.S. wins the war and dictates the peace, because our involvement will be strong enough to that it gives us the right and the edge to make the peace, our allies may have gotten into this to steal land, but we'll end up making it a just and fair peace. This is the kind of thinking, these are the ramblings that historians go through. I think all historians, if they dream about if I was president and I could rewrite the world, this is how I would fix it. I see this in Wilson, working this way. He put together the pamphlets, and dropped them over the enemy nations in early 1918 in German and in Austrian and Turkish language. Austrian's German, but I mean the Czech language too. He dropped these pamphlets over the enemy in hopes that they would surrender early to get a fair peace treaty. Here are the categories of what the 14 points address. The first one, point one, is called open covenants arrived at openly, or open diplomacy. Open covenants arrived at openly. What is a covenant? It's a promise, a contract, an agreement, an obligation. So when he's talking about in terms of diplomacy or agreements between nations, open diplomacy arrived at openly, what's he meaning? Or what's he attacking, really?
All the secret alliances.
Yeah, yep. Secret treaties and secret alliances in which nobody knew who was allied to whom, which may have been the cause for all this outbreak of war. If you have to do things above board, in the open, in the eyes of the press, where everybody can see, what's the difference?
Nobody has to guess. Nobody has to wonder.
And therefore, how will the outcome be different?
There won't be any
secret. Yeah, there's the check and balance of the people. It's more democratic. It's more supposedly fair. What time is this being done, anyway? What year here? 1918? What domestic movement is going on at the same time, or about dying going on at the same time? What domestic reform movement from 1900 to about 1916 had been going on?
Progressivism.
And one of the watchwords of progressivism was more democracy. More people voting, making the Senate popularly elected, giving women the right to vote. So there is this kind of philosophical belief that if you can make foreign policy run more diplomatic, more scientific, more efficient. It's progressivism in foreign policy. It has to work. It has to work well. But you can't pull fast ones on the people when they're all watching. You have to do what's right for them. How was our Constitution derived? Was it an open covenant arrived at openly?
No.
Not at all. Yeah, there was a press ban. They closed up the doors. Nobody was allowed to speak. And they built the whole thing throughout the summer. Yeah. And then released it after the fact. Does that mean our document is suspect, or does that mean sometimes you can't get anything done when everybody's watching? I think that's it. Can you imagine labor representative and a factory owner going out to do their negotiations on CNN live? No way that's going to work out. So Wilson's idealistic here, but he's got a right point is that ultimately the more the light of day shines upon things, the harder it is for conspiracy to last. Second category, freedom of the seas, the right of any nation that is a neutral to trade anywhere regardless of peace or wartime. Pardon? Somebody asked?
So?
Freedom of the seas, the right of any neutral nation to trade in any waters during war or peacetime. The protection of neutrals, trade. Does that strike you as a major human rights of international law that needed to be addressed? Is there any possible other convenient angle to this? Yeah, I'm being cynical here, but I think it's Wilson's way of saying we shouldn't feel guilty that we were trading 90% to the British and 10% for the Germans. We were a neutral that should have had our rights protected. So that's where I think he's going with that. Here's the one that was the most controversial of all, arms reductions. And this comes back to these major causes of the war. In many ways, the 14 points address the four causes: secret treaties, militarism, imperialism, nationalism. They're all going to try to resolve the foundation causes of this war. And so the belief is that if the buildup of armaments caused the war to turn so terrible, the limitation or the reduction of arms can prevent wars from being bad or even breaking out. Wilson was naive enough to wish that they could reduce armaments to the size that nothing larger than could be carried on the shoulder of a foot soldier. That's not going to happen. But this belief that peace is maintained by less weaponry is in complete contrast to the opposite view of armed to the teeth makes people afraid of you. And it's going to be a debated issue in the 1920s and 30s. There will be negotiations in the 20s. They'll fall apart. People agree to them, will later attack us. There'll be a great cynicism after World War II to never negotiate with your enemy on arms reductions, especially with the Soviets. So arms negotiations from 1945 to 1987, 86 I should say, flirt with limitations, but never go so far as reductions. We're not going to be stupid enough to reduce our arms in the face of an enemy that later starts a world war and nearly defeats us because of it. But then in 1987, the President of the United States that called the Russians the evil empire negotiated the first arms reductions talks, the INF Treaty with Gorbachev in 87. Who was this? Reagan, the one who is the cold warrior of them all, was the one who engaged in arms reductions. Why? Weren't we foolishly putting ourselves at risk for a Russian and Soviet attack? But we were offering to do the same also. And we were allowing inspectors to verify in both cases. We were allowed to go over there and they were allowed them to come.
That's just it. It's because of the verification of the inspectors that both were doing what they said they were going to do.
But, well, you're right. I mean, that's the practicality, as Reagan put it, trust but verify. I mean, that was clearly in there. But why would he even politically get near something like that when he'd made his reputation, like Nixon, on being a cold warrior?
I mean, we already know that the Soviet Union.
There's part of it. It's the belief is that if we can get, they desperately needed to start spending money on consumer goods instead of weapons. And so they were begging for this. And Gorbachev was a person that maybe you could trust. And Reagan had his own problems to deal with too. It wasn't all just on the Russian side. What was Reagan facing in 1986 and 87? The Iran-Contra affair. And so he needed some good news that the public wanted. And there were a lot of movies in the 80s about the fear of a nuclear nightmare getting out of hand. And so he moved at the right time and reversed his position, and the public loved it. So I'm not saying it's all cynical. I always tend to explain things and what's good for votes, because he didn't need re-election anymore. But I think it was a major step for Reagan to trust a Russian and do so. But it tells you something. From 1945 to 1987, was this near 50 years before even the thought of arms reductions could be occurred because of the failure before World War II. And it gets its start here. This is the first time it's proposed by Woodrow Wilson in the 14 points. Self-determination specifically for estranged national minorities. This means the creation of new nations built around people with common ethnicity or language, which, as we said before, was part of the cause of the war, especially in Bosnia. And then the last and most important of the 14 points, the one that mattered the most to Wilson, was the creation of a General Association of Nations, an international tribunal where nations could come and engage in dialogue before war to solve things. This is what he thought would be the key to ending all wars. That if you had, like a Congress, a tribunal for people to talk things out, and people treat each other with respect, you could resolve things without war.
Did this evolve into the UN?
It reincarnated into the UN. Its first life was the what?
Its first life was what?
From 1920 to 1939, what did they call this thing? League of Nations. And how well did the League of Nations work?
Well, we had World War II.
Yeah, in the mid-30s, when the Axis power started taking over Asia and Africa and elsewhere, League of Nations did nothing to stop it. Why was the League... of the many reasons, what's one of the reasons why the League failed? We didn't join. That's going to be the key element of the story here, is that we dream it up, then we never join. And then when it fails, we say, gee, good thing we didn't join. But what you say...
What if we had...
Well, you know, it's almost like saying, what if you had really... Yeah. The isolationist mood is so strong. We're going to see why we don't join. But the isolationist mood is so strong, that's why we don't join. Which probably pretty well explains that even if we had become members, it's unlikely we would have committed ourselves to serious enforcement of the law. It's like saying to somebody who flunked, if you just stayed up and studied all night, if I'd stayed up and forced you to study, well, I think if there wasn't a commitment there to begin with, it would have been consistent. And that's why after Pearl Harbor and the whole change in attitude, there is this desire to build a new organization called the United Nations. And you still hear today a lot of people talk about the United Nations is weak, it doesn't work, we should quit, we should get rid of it. In fact, you know why the United Nations is in New York City rather than in Europe? The League of Nations was headquartered in Europe, but they put the United Nations in New York City. Any guess why? You would think that's it, that because we won the war and made the difference and made all the weapons that we get to dictate where the... It wasn't it at all. The Europeans wanted it here. And the reason being is... Yeah. If the party's at your house, you can't quit drinking early. I mean, so that was the theory behind it is, you put the United Nations in the U.S., it's harder to quit. And I don't think we would have quit, but I think the movement to quit could have been stronger if it was elsewhere. Well, we will come back to more League of Nations discussion. Item 29, Pershing. You remember Pershing? He was sent to catch Pancho Villa, never did find him. He's reassigned to prepare and lead American Expeditionary Forces, World War I troops, to France, which he does. And they make a decisive difference in a number of battles. These are the three most significant in France: Belleau Wood, Loos Argonne, and the Chateau Thierry battles. We talked about this a little while back, about the article concerning World War I veterans that are still left alive, the 12 of them. This is what's mentioned down here. There was online and in the Fort Smith paper little biographies of each of those people if you're curious about them. Here's something I read recently about the Moose Argonne battle. Had to do with the contribution of Native Americans. It's real common to remember that Navajo Indians were used in World War II with their language so that the Japanese couldn't break the codes. But I know I had read somewhere, and I went back and did some research and found out that wasn't the first time it happened. The Choctaw were used in World War I at this battle because Germans were deciphering what was being said over the radio, so they used Choctaw language and as a result were able to win the battle. So they don't get enough credit for it, but the Choctaw soldiers are the ones that made that victory happen. And it is believed that Congress, in response to and appreciation to the Choctaw contribution, in 1924 made all Native American citizens, an act of Congress. Wouldn't it seem like Native Americans should have already been citizens back in 1868 with the 14th Amendment? Let me read that one to you here. If you're into the upset at immigration because people come over here and have children, you won't like the 14th Amendment. If you're one of those people on the bandwagon to get rid of natural-born citizenship, here's where it comes from. I don't think anybody is in here, but 14th Amendment, this is right after the 13th. It's all about post-Civil War activity. All persons born or naturalized in the United States and subject to the jurisdiction thereof are citizens of the United States in the state where they reside. So this says if you're born here, you're a citizen. So weren't Native Americans born under the jurisdiction of the United States government? So why weren't they citizens until 1924? Pardon?
I mean, weren't they still viewed as being
subhuman? Well, in that respect, weren't the amendment's original purpose was for whom? Okay. How were African Americans perceived in vis-a-vis Native Americans? So why were they considered citizens? And that was the intent. Obviously, the 14th Amendment was to enfranchise African Americans as citizens. So why didn't that just automatically take in Indians? Yes, that's it. The courts, as early as the 1830s, had put down a policy of saying Native American nations, reservations, regions, and lands are almost kind of like a foreign nation within our nation. Now, that interpretation of the courts originally was passed to protect them. It was to keep them from being forced migrated to Oklahoma, which they ended up doing anyway. It didn't help them. So in the beginning, the nation within a nation legal status was for protection. Then later it came to be used as, if you are a nation within a nation, you're not fully an American citizen. So it was used against them. So that's why the 24 Act came. Another event that occurred during World War I that's not talked about as much as you might think is the outbreak of a swine flu epidemic, in which worldwide 21 million people died and 500,000 were Americans. It's definitely considered to be because of all the troop movements to and from Europe and from the Far East, working people from China, that this flu spread. My grandmother, who was born in 1893, so how old would you be in 1918 if you're born in 1893? 21 maybe? 27? Born in 1893 and then 25, okay. At age 25, she and my grandfather both had the swine flu in Abilene, Texas, or the outskirts of Abilene, Texas, and said they can remember laying sick in bed, wondering if they're going to survive, hearing the carts being rolled outside, looking for bodies put in, just like some medieval movie. That exactly is how she described it, like some kind of, what do you call those people? Monty Python type situation, when she describes themselves. Well, it's kind of freaky. When was the next time a swine flu scare occurred? Does anybody remember in America? 1975. There was the fear that it was going to happen like it did back in 1918. So Ford, the president, ordered that vaccine be made available for everybody. Does anybody remember that? And then, of course, we've got this recent bird flu thing that people have been thinking about. So.
Before that, we're dealing with SARS, on the SARS scare.
Mm-hmm. Which?
The girl in Egypt supposedly has the bird flu right now.
Somebody in Egypt?
Yeah.
But not here yet. Well, and with the air traffic the way it is, it could get here now. Anyway, this is me deviating here, but I thought this was of interest. Well, 30 is true. U.S. involvement makes the difference in the war. The transference of German troops from the Russian front doesn't help them. People are going broke. The government's falling apart. The Kaiser, in the first week of November, runs off to Holland to take refuge. And so a semblance of a German government seeks surrender. And on November 11th, 1918, not 1917, as it's falsely typed here, number 31, 1918, an armistice is negotiated, and it is in commemoration of that 11th month, 11th day, in fact negotiated at the 11th hour, that Veterans Day was later established in recognition of. So the fighting is over in November of 1918, and now it's time for the peace treaty. Wilson will be the first person to cross the ocean while in office and to visit Europe. And when he arrives, he is welcomed in Paris with hearty parades and confetti and banners and worshiping French, calling out his name, which is very misleading and confusing to him because he gets the feeling he is the conquering champion and can dictate the peace easily. He thinks it's going to be just a slam dunk 14 points coming up here at this treaty. Held at the Versailles Palace in the Room of Mirrors. The Hall of Mirrors, I should say. If you've been to Versailles, that's really a fascinating part of the palace to visit because you can sit there and just kind of envision Wilson and the others talking and fighting out the 14 points. Wilson represented the United States. George Clemenceau represented France. David Lloyd George, there should be a hyphen between Lloyd and George, for England, and Vittorio Orlando for Italy, are the big four negotiators. Lloyd George is the British Prime Minister. Clemenceau is the French President. Wilson's obviously from the United States, and Orlando is the Prime Minister of Italy.
Prime Minister?
Yes. So again, Wilson naively believes that he's going to be able to tell these others because of the American difference that is made, the 14 points should be the treaty. Well, Orlando surely didn't get into this war for human rights. In fact, he and his nation stayed out of the war for 1 year, negotiating secretly on both sides to figure out the best deal, and that's why they joined the winning side. So his concern is gain for Italy. And in fact, the cities he was promised never do go to Italy, and twice he storms out in a rage, and they don't care because the war's over anyway.
What's he
going to
do?
So there... That's a good point. I guess because they didn't make that big of a contribution, and the more obvious answer is they weren't white. I think, well, there is going to be some Japanese, and the Japanese do attend. They don't have a representative of major import, but they do attend and they do have an input. And part of this is these 21 demands. I think I mentioned this before, that they had, in 1915, put upon China a list of territorial demands that should be transferred from Chinese to Japanese occupation. They were willing to trade these demands for a plank in the Versailles Treaty acknowledging racial equality. I think we mentioned that already, and that Wilson said he just couldn't do it, couldn't get it ratified with senators in the United States. So Orlando is not in the stream of consciousness of the 14 points. Lloyd George and Clemenceau, their concerns are this. The war was started by the Germans. The Germans are always going to be a problem. There's going to be another war with the Germans. It's foolish to start thinking in terms of human rights and international law. The best thing we can do is weaken the German nation so it takes longer for them to start World War II. And since we won the war, German and Turkish colonies should become our colonies. So weakening Germany and stealing colonies are their priority. So Wilson finds himself up against it and starts to trade away and bargain away point by point of the 14 points. Some of the self-determination is agreed upon, and mostly the part that he finds worth the trade is the salvation of the 14th point, the creation of a League of Nations. But in the treaty that comes about, item 33 lists the provisions. First, Germany is given a limit on its military weaponry, how much they can have in hardware militarily. Second, that's on 33. It's going to come all confusing here in a minute. I'm just doing all of 33 of them. Yeah, arms reductions occur not on the winners, but on Germany. Here's the Rhine River. So the Versailles Treaty made it illegal for Germany to move any of its armaments west of the Rhine River, so there'd be a demilitarized zone between the Rhine and France, Belgium, and the Netherlands. That's part of the provision. Did we talk about Alsace and Lorraine yet? Alsace and Lorraine provinces. They're in this area here. These are regions. Yeah, Germany took them in the Franco-Prussian War away from France, and they had about equal amounts of German and French-speaking people mixed within themselves. France is going to take it back now as part of this treaty, which will be the basis for Hitler's propaganda later that he needs to reunite German-speaking people. Germany is given full blame for the war, which is, we know, not true. They all share in the reasons that it started. If anybody gets blamed, probably should be Serbians that helped the Bosnian Serbs. In addition to being fully blamed for the war, Germany is also given reparations payments to make to the winners. And in the beginning in the treaty here, there's no limit. they're just to pay war damages until the winners feel that things are repaired. In 1929, that limit will be set at $33 billion. And then a year later, they stop paying anyway because of the Depression. New nations are created, not to fit exactly the formula that Wilson had in his 14 points, but many of them do. And we can see here,
that the orange country is the one we're talking about. Yeah, new states created. Finland, Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, Poland, the separate Czechoslovakia, smaller separated Austria-Hungary, adding Bosnia and Serbia together, and Croatia, creating a Yugoslavic nation. The Turkish Empire is also divided up, and your Palestine, Lebanon, Syria, Transjordan, Algeria, Libya, Egypt, those places are all given either to France, England, or Italy as colonies. The Ottoman Turkish Empire. So the war ends the empire and strips them of their lands. And that also creates the circumstance for trouble in Palestine, Israel. We talked about the Balfour Declaration, maybe?
Yes. Okay, at the same time that they're promising Jewish people in England and America a chance for a homeland in Palestine, they have also promised the Palestinian Arabs independence from the Turks. And in reality, they deliver to neither. For the first 20 years, they just say, this is a British colony, everybody behave. What changes the formula in Palestine? Hitler's persecution of Jewish people and then the migration of those Jews left to Palestine after World War II upsets everything, or changes everything, I should say.
We have on 33 that new nations were created to
see the list versus. I just did it. I'll do it again. Sorry.
Okay.
Here's the list again. Finland, Estonia, Latvia.
Wait a minute. Can't write that fast.
Okay.
Finland, Estonia,
Latvia, Lithuania, Poland, things are making too much sense. I got to interrupt and do a little side talk here. You notice that right after World War II starts, that Germany and Russia gobble up Poland, and Russia invades Latvia, Lithuania, Estonia, Poland. Within the first 6 months of World War II, the map's restored back to pre-World War I conditions. Poland, Czechoslovakia, and Yugoslavia. Those are the major new nations created.
Wasn't it Russia completely pretty close to the war?
Dead.
That's the beginning of the World War II, Russia.
Oh, yeah. And it took the Russians 8 months to defeat Finland, which made a lot of people wonder. And we'll get into that later about the secret treaties between Germany and Russia right before the war starts. Poland especially is something to point out and mention. You can't see it from where you're at here, but this is an East Prussia or an eastern portion of Germany, disconnected from the west of Germany so that Poland could have a corridor to the Baltic Sea. A port city. It was once called Danzig and now it's called Gdansk. Oh, I better shut up. Sorry. We'll come back and do the Polish thing next time around. Sorry about that.